One is the loneliest number that you'll ever do. Two can be as bad as one. It's the loneliest number since the number one.
Hi, and welcome to the Movies You Love podcast, the podcast where I get to sit down every other week, or I should probably not even state that as a thing now, because I've realized I've gotten a little bit, ill-timed with all of my releases, because now this one is going to be coming out a week after the last one, but the last one came out like a month after the one before it, so I'm getting all messed up in all of my timings. But this is the podcast where I get to sit down and talk with all sorts of interesting bloggers and writers all along the internet about films that they love, films that help them fall in love with movies. And this week I have on with me Courtney Small, the man from the site formerly known as Big Thoughts from a Small Mind, now known as CinemaAxis.com. Axis.com, not Access. CinemaAxis.com. And he's also on Twitter at Small Mind. Go tweet him and say, hey, you listened to the episode, because he should know that he's kind of awesome. Because when you listen to this episode, like, this is one of those episodes where I'm really happy with it, because we got into so many things within the conversation. It became so much like I know he knows this, probably, hopefully. If he doesn't, you're hearing it now, Courtney. I hope this conversation like went on another 5 hours of us just going into everything in life and just all sorts of things, because that's what I want to do. That's what I want this show to be, and I'm so happy that this one kind of turned out this well. This week we sit down, I don't know if I've said it already, we talk about Paul Thomas Anderson's Magnolia. And if you've ever seen that film, you can understand how that movie becomes like a wonderful little startup point for any sort of conversation you want to have. And I think that might be why I'm so happy for you guys to be hearing this episode right now. So I'm gonna stop talking now. I'm gonna let you just hear the conversation we had, and go watch Magnolia, guys.
There are stories of coincidence and chance and intersections and strange things told, and which is which and who only knows. And we generally say, well, if that was in a movie, I wouldn't believe it.
And I'm going to start off by saying, Courtney, it's been at least 3 months since I saw you.
Since TIFF,
and it's so nice to hear your voice again. You've come on the podcast this time around to talk about the Paul Thomas Anderson 1999 film Magnolia. I think it's not a very hard stretch for me to presume that this was a theatrical first adopter story for you.
Yes, but I was familiar with Paul Thomas Anderson before Magnolia. I had actually seen Hard Eight, or I guess what was called Sydney in some parts of the States, back when I was in high school. On TV here, we have a station called channel called Showcase. And back in the day, Cameron Bailey, before he was Mr. TIFF, used to host a Saturday night movie show, him and a Canadian actress by the name, I believe it was Valerie Bahajar. And they would show foreign films and indie films. And I remember seeing Hard Eight on TV way back when I was in high school. And then for me, I really kind of started to get into Paul Thomas Anderson when I was in university. Because like my first year of university, I was fortunate enough to see Boogie Nights on the big screen. And then in my second year, I saw Hard Eight again, because I had a bunch of friends who were actually film majors that had never seen it. And then come third year, Magnolia came out, and I actually got to experience it theatrically. And, you know, that was an experience that changed me.
That sounds very interesting, because unlike a lot of my guests who come on here and talk about their films, like, it sounds like you very much had a basis of like a film knowledge to go into Magnolia. It wasn't your first experience of this kind of thing, was it?
No, it wasn't my first experience, but it came at a time when my film going habits were changing. Because I'm an only child, I pretty much spent most of my high school, even junior high, I'd say probably from age 12 to about 17, just staying home and watching movies either on Showcase or what we have up here, the Movie Network, which I guess is the equivalent of HBO in the States. And I was just watching a ton of stuff just because there was nothing else to do. So I was familiar with American independent cinema. I was familiar with foreign films like Javier Bardem. I discovered in films like Hamal Hamal and was it The Golden Balls and, you know, just various things. So I had that basis, but I had never actually watched those type of films in the theater. The few times that I did go to the theater when I was younger, it was to go see The Cable Guy, Speed, you know, like the big budget Hollywood releases. It never dawned on me that, hey, you could go and see these quirky films and these different films in theaters with a group of people that thought the same way as you.
So, okay, all right. This is your first theatrical experience with independent cinema, with something different than the blockbuster Hollywood corporation-made film. Tell me about that experience. Tell me about going in versus walking out 3 hours later.
Well, it was interesting. I wouldn't say it was my very first experience with independent cinema, but within that time of university, I went to a lot of different independent films. But for Magnolia in particular, because I had seen Hard Eight and because I had seen Boogie Nights, I remember seeing the trailer, and it was a weird trailer where it was just the characters introducing themselves. So it was like, I'm Jimmy Gator, I'm Frank T.J. Mackey, and then the voiceover said, at the end, this will all make sense. So when it opened in Toronto, it only played one theater, and it was during the Christmas week that it had opened, I guess just probably just before or maybe after Christmas, and it was playing at the Paramount, which you know as the Scotiabank.
Okay.
And I remember thinking, all right, it's only playing in one theater. It's going to go wide in January, but I really want to see this film. So hopped on the subway from the Burbs, went downtown, and since I got downtown early, I said, well, you know what? Since I'm here, I'm going to do two films. So I did The Talented Mr. Ripley first, which was like 2.5 hours. And then right after that, I walked into Magnolia. And by the time that day was done, I had completely forgotten that I'd seen The Talented Mr. Ripley because I was just so immersed with Magnolia. And I think what originally struck me about it was such a simple film in terms of its themes, but how Paul Thomas Anderson had constructed it was just, in my opinion, was, you know, just visionary. Like the way how he starts off with the voiceover and the narrative of the three random scenes of coincidence. And once the film starts, you think, all right, well, the coincidence is just going to be that all these people are linked. And then things start happening in the film, and then you get to the big finale. And when you get to the big finale, he reminds you, wait a minute, I told you, I set this all up at the very beginning. Within the first 15 minutes, you know, so if you're paying close attention, it all makes sense, right? And it was one of those where I hadn't seen a film quite like it, especially in the theater. Like, I know some people I could hear walking out kind of grumbling about it, especially towards the ending, which a lot of people seem to hate. But for me, it was one of those rare moments where I just walked out of the theater thinking, you know what? I got it. To me, it made sense. Similar to like when I saw Mulholland Drive a few years later, I remember one guy yelling out in the theater, what the hell was that? Whereas for me, the minute Mulholland Drive ended, I went, wow, I think that's the first David Lynch film that I actually get. Like, you know, something just connected with me where all the pieces landed perfectly, you know?
Oh, wow. Because that was one of the things I wanted to talk about with this film, which was meaning. This movie is something which is riddled with the problem of meaning, where people always feel they need to attribute a definite meaning towards a film or whatever, but this movie offers up so many different angles as to how you can interpret it and how you can understand it and things that you can read into, and some of which I'd like to call MacGuffins. But at the same time, it never really asks it of you. It never asks you to actually give it the meaning. It asks you to just fall into its own little realm of madness. But you say that you actually walked out of it going, I get it. So I'm curious, like, what is the meaning that you walked out of this movie with, and has it changed at all over the years?
It hasn't changed. It's evolved a bit more. The very first one, and probably the most obvious meaning that struck me, was every action you have, and again, it's a very simple thing, every action you have has consequences, and they make several references, you know, and the good book says we may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us. And it happens throughout the entire film. And you see the cycle keep repeating itself until a big event happens, or at some point a character must decide whether or not they're going to make a change in their life, or they're just going to continue with that cycle. So that was the very first one that I got. Over the years, as I've watched it over and over, and as I've gotten older, I started to pick out themes of what does it mean to be a man? Because it's very much a film about fathers and sons, you know. Well, I guess there's these Claudia, so you could even say fathers and daughters, but there's very much the old guard of what it means to be a man, whereas Earl, Partridge, and Jimmy Gator, they're very much, well, a man cheats on his wife, sleeps around with many women, you know, shows his dominance. Whereas someone like John C. Reilly's character, Jim, he's a very weak man in theory. He's a very good-natured person, but he loses his gun. You know, he even at a crime scene, he loses his position in terms of reporting, and he's the first man on the scene, right? So he's deemed as the weak man. And Frank T.J. Mackey is that guy who is trying to show the bravado of the manly man, the old archetype of a man, but in reality, when you get down to it, that version of the man does not exist. You know, that ideal of mankind and manliness does not really exist. What it really means to be a man is something completely different. You know, so that was another thing that I got out of it the more I started to watch it. And then, of course, there's the, I'll say religious theme, although I think the film handles religion in a very tactful way, in this sense that it's not necessarily about following the Bible or being, you know, a devout Christian. It's simply taking the concept of religion in terms of being good to one another. You know, the world would be such a better place if we all just took a moment and were nicer to each other. You know, didn't try to be something we're not, focused on helping each other opposed to helping ourselves. So that was another theme that the more I started watching and really just studying the film, I was like, you know what, this is starting to speak to me even further.
That's kind of interesting, talking about the religious themes, because I remember that being something that I didn't necessarily notice upon my first few viewings of this film, because this is one of my favorite movies that I've seen over the years, where I almost like it in a way that I can't describe to people. Because the moment that people try to ask me to define why I like this movie, I get kind of flustered in all of these separate things, and I start to throw down words like it just ends up cool, right? Mm-hmm. And it's one of those things where it may have been the first time I kind of experienced some very intentional directing and visual directing in filmmaking. And when things just come out of left corner, things like even the ultimate frog scene, right, in this movie, like, you're kind of left wondering and you're not sure whether you're looking left or right in the film. And then I found out about this whole religious undertone that people kept talking about, and I wasn't quite sure where to take it. I kind of base it on my own lack of knowledge of the Bible or of the specifics of Christianity. But I find it very interesting to hear you talk about the idea of the world being better if we were just good to each other, which is the moral, which is the stance of Christianity and a good Christian. But is it that you're saying that when you look throughout all of the storylines, where there's some where it's obvious where about people are being horrendous to each other and people who had been bad to one another, are you saying that throughout each storyline we could see a complete change in their position, their actual demeanor and their output if in their lives people were just good to them?
I think so. Like the obvious one in that instance for me would be Quiz Kid Donnie Smith, because his life was essentially ruined by his parents stealing his money, his parents being, you know, taking advantage of him. So he went from being this Quiz Kid genius that had, you know, was adored by millions to working at a shop where he's losing his job and, you know, doesn't know how to express love because love has never been truly expressed to him properly. So he thinks that to to get the love of the bartender, he must look like the bartender and get the braces so that they can share something in common. He's one where initially you see that whole, how should I put this? He's the first one for me where it kind of struck, well, hey, if his parents were nicer to him and showed him kindness, his life would be different. You know, and that's why at the very end of his storyline, there's that scene where Officer Jim and Donnie are talking underneath the, I believe it's the gas station. And, you know, that's the one of the first moments where Donnie gets true human connection and true human kindness. And Officer Jim even helps him to take the money back into the store. And, you know, you kind of get the sense that he's going to at least be there to help him through this rough transition patch. Earl Partridge, when he's on his deathbed, one of the big regrets that he has is that he wasn't kinder to his wife. His wife, in, by all accounts, was a decent woman, and he just treated like crap constantly, you know, kept cheating on her, this and that, and even when she was dying, was not there for her or his son. And Moore is essentially the trophy wife who openly admits all she cared about was Earl Partridge's money. But as he was dying and she started to see the real man that he was, she starts to feel the guilt, you know, the guilt of she could have been nicer to him. You know, she may have learned to love him had she just been nicer from the start, right? So it's that kind of connection that I start to notice that would flow throughout each storyline.
Because, as I said, this is a movie which I kind of almost for good, I'm making up words in my head, almost... didn't want to try and define the more I dove into each storyline, because I felt too bogged down in actually walking through the logic of each character's motions. Because I would go through things where I would go through that bar scene of Quiz Kid Donnie Smith with the older gentleman.
Oh, Thurston, yes, one of my favorite side characters in that movie.
Right, and I would just have so much fun enjoying the moment of these scenes that I would move past trying to figure out what the problem with Quiz Kid Donnie Smith was. And I mean, it's kind of amazing to hear someone have such a quick grasp on this movie. I'm kind of curious. You even brought up another movie which falls under this category of things people have trouble defining, and that's David Lynch's Mulholland Drive. Yes. Like, is it that you find yourself having an aptitude for films like this?
I think over the years, I just started finding myself getting drawn to it. Like, I'll be the first to admit, Magnolia is a film that, even as a film blogger, I have never wrote about. It's kind of one of those things that I love, and I know that a lot of people don't, so I just kind of keep in my little precious bubble that I don't want people ruining for, just because I have my own interpretation of what I think it's going to be. But yeah, I found that when I was in high school, I liked a lot more of the big budget stuff, the Michael Bays and whatnot, you know, the John Woo action films. But the more I started experiencing different types of cinema, and I started seeing the ways that different directors were telling stories, whether it be through images or through their narrative, I just found myself being drawn to things. Like, Mulholland Drive is one of the few David Lynch films where I could watch over and over. I still am not a David Lynch expert. The man confuses me more often than I can understand him, but I'm at least willing to see what new offerings he has. But there's something about Paul Thomas Anderson and his films that with each one, I just find I connect with so much. And I think with Magnolia in particular, and this one took me years to really figure out why I connect so much with this film, but part of it is because my parents divorced when I was really young. So I grew up in with my mom, single parent household. And as I said, I just watched a lot of movies. And it was interesting in terms of how he was showing concepts of fatherhood and what it means to be a father, being with a person who essentially my father was my mother. You know, my mother was the mother and the father in the household. You know, I didn't have that quote unquote manly role model that eventually came in one of my uncles. But within my actual household, that's just how it was. And now that I'm a father myself, I'm always trying to think of the stuff that I'm doing and how is it reflecting on my son, you know? And when I get annoyed with him, am I being like Stanley's father? Am I, you know, being too unruly? Or, you know, it's stuff like that. So this film over the years keeps growing with me, I guess, which is rare for certain films.
Is it that you kind of, is it that over the years, your viewpoint of manliness, of what it means to be a man, not necessarily coming from this movie or anything else, has it shifted in any sort of definition when from that point in time of a childhood, like when you probably saw this film to now?
From when I first saw it, I think the biggest change is I have a broader perspective. When I was in university, you know, I find university is a time that really kind of shapes who you are as a person, right? And you really start to become more comfortable with yourself. Because in high school, you spend a lot of time trying to be what you're not, what you think everyone wants you to be. Whereas university, I start to just kind of be comfortable with who I am. And from the time that I first saw this film in 99 to now, so much has happened in my life. But I've noticed that my reasoning and how I look at things has also evolved. You know, I'm not so quick to judge. I can look at the various angles and the various perspectives. I can see the good and the bad with particular situations. In terms of manhood and manliness, I think I'm just, my view now is, you know, being a man is a person who takes care of his responsibilities, but also his family and his friends. You know, he treats people well. He doesn't have to be the Frank T.J. Mackey wannabe stud, you know, when you're in an interview doing all these aerobics with your shirt off even before the camera starts rolling. You know, that's not what it means to be a man. Like, whether or not you're the popular person doesn't really matter. It's about who you are and are you good to others? You know, are you taking care of those who are near and dear to you, whether it be through kindness, through support? That for me, that's the new definition I have for manhood. It's no longer the Stallone, real man has the muscles and grabs the girl and shoots up the people. You know, it's not the James Bond, suave, debonair ladies man. It's the average Joe that does what he has to do to ensure that his life and the life of those around him is a little bit better.
All right, so bringing it back to this movie a little bit more, to kind of talk about, as we've been talking about manliness, men, people who in their life have had bad things happen to them and the consequence of those, I'm kind of curious, is when you watch this film, like, do you find yourself shifting from character to character as to who you're willing to not necessarily align yourself with, because I don't think anyone wants to align themselves with anyone in this movie, actually, or anyone specific, but as in who you would more focus on what's in his life right now and what kind of looks fascinating to you?
Yes, but I it all really just depends on who Anderson decides to focus on at that moment in time. I find it's one of the few films where he's got multiple stories going on and each one is extremely fascinating to me. So like we were talking, you know, the scenes with Donnie and Thurston at the bar, you know, I could watch a whole film with those two men going back and forth with one another, you know, or following Donnie through his hardships. I find Stanley, although I guess he kind of gets dropped about the halfway point of the film, his relationship and his storyline is really fascinating, especially when they're on the quiz show and you realize that, you know, the only reason these kids are racking up all these points is because of him. He's doing all the legwork and the other kids are talking about going on auditions and getting TV deals, but he's not really doing anything. You know, there's times where Frank T.J. Mackey, as pompous as he is, when he's giving those seminars, I find it just hilarious, you know, and how he's trying to tell people how to fake like you're nice and caring and that will help you attract women. You know, those each section has their moments. So there's times where I'll be following Jim Curran and being so engaged and wrapped up into his story. And then I'll find myself being drawn to the way Julianne Moore is slowly having a mental breakdown, you know, and especially in that great scene where She's at the pharmacist with a guy from, well, I'm forgetting his name, but he was in the film The Innkeepers.
Okay.
And he was also the man in the first narrative that, or the first coincidence that gets killed.
Greenberry Hill?
Yes, the Greenberry Hill guy. He plays the young pharmacist that is subtly questioning Julianne Moore about why does she need all these medications.
Yeah.
I'm forgetting his name right now, but I just saw him in Cheap Thrills about a month or two ago at Toronto After Dark. But anyway, like that sequence there was interesting. Like, you know, following as she is slowly just going off the edge until she has that point where, you know, she tries to kill herself and the little black kid finds her and, you know, ends up saving her life. And it's just, you know, Claudia. At the beginning, Claudia, I find, was probably the most fascinating one at the very beginning because you really don't get to know too much about her. You know that she does drugs and that she sleeps around and that she really hates Jimmy Gator, you know, and she's got this drug habit and she's just the girl with a drug habit. And then you, as the film evolves, you start realizing, you know what? No, she's damaged, you know, and why is she damaged? She's damaged because of her father in ways that you would never even think of, or you wouldn't want to think of how damaged she is. And seeing her go on a date with this guy who was, you know, devoutly religious, very mild-mannered, always trying to see the good in people, it's a fascinating dynamic.
You talked about earlier about this being like one of your favorite movies, and at the same time you kind of have this understanding of how other people view this movie, and You keep it very close to you. You don't really let it out to be like, hey, this is the movie, and for everyone to start that discussion of really, or for the misunderstanding. I'm curious as to how you are when it comes to generally sharing this movie with people, when it comes to selling someone who's never seen it versus discussing it with someone who's seen it before.
Well, let me just say that it used to be the, I don't want to say the benchmark, but for former girlfriends, it would be the film where I'm like, you gotta see Magnolia. You know, if you want to watch a movie, like, let's watch Magnolia. It's my favorite film. You'll love it. And then after they'd see it, they'd be like, huh, that's, well, it had its part. You know, it had its nice moments. And it's one of those, I was, okay, you know, this is a film I can't force on people because I just know that others aren't going to, like, I don't even think my own wife has seen this movie, and she's slowly starting to watch a little more movies, but it's one where I'm like, you know what? You're not ready for Magnolia just yet. I'm always willing to.
So you figured out by the time you met your wife that you shouldn't be doing this as a litmus test.
Yes. This is not the litmus test movie. You know, maybe do like Toy Story 2 or WALL-E to ease people in. But I'm always willing to discuss this film with people. It's just, I find, like, partly because of the frogs and maybe even just the length. And the frogs is only really, if you think about it, the frogs is only like the last 10 minutes of the film, you know, because people are always like, oh, I was with it until the frogs. I'm like, but the frogs was only the final 10 minutes. But just because there's so much going on in this film and, you know, the random act of God, if you will, I find people are just, you know, ready to tear it apart. And I always find that interesting because I look at something like Pulp Fiction, and Pulp Fiction has, you know, one of the most memorable random acts of God moments that kind of changes the course of the entire film, and people have no problem with it. You know, they are completely fine to follow that story and believe that someone could shoot at you at point blank range, fire off what, 20 shots, and not a single bullet hit you because Tarantino made it cool, right? Whereas Anderson, I guess, made it too deep or too complicated with the frog moment. So I don't know. Sorry, I think I'm getting off topic from your original question.
No. That's perfect. But not necessarily to break you apart, but to just discuss that idea you brought up, versing point blank range in Pulp Fiction versus the frogs here. I feel like this falls under the problem that I think I heard Lars von Trier talk about when he was discussing Breaking the Waves, which is a film I have yet to see, but I've heard about this. I know, I've heard. Where he said that when he was making that film and when he was structuring it, when he when he put it down, he threw in the bells at the end, right? Where he almost wanted it to be that breaking point for the audience, where they were going, if you are with this movie, this is going to be the point where people just break off and go, screw whatever the hell that man made, to, oh my goodness, I love how far he went. And I feel like The Frogs is almost that in this movie, where even if you haven't caught on to the religious undertones of this movie at any point yet, other than saying, oh, John C. Reilly's character is kind of religious, this will be the point in the movie where you're going to stop caring and you're going to go completely left turn and say, this movie is balls crazy, or you're going to be 100% in love with this movie for going there. And I appreciate filmmakers who do that, even though I know that it's a gamble.
Yes, it is a risk. But for me, I think the breaking point in Magnolia is actually the, I guess, musical interlude that occurs probably like 2/3 of the way in, when all the characters start breaking out into song. You know, for me, that was the point where I'm thinking, okay, people are either going to lose it at this point, or they're going to stick with it. You know, the frogs was just like a bonus, you know, considering all the other stuff that happens. But when you have every character singing, and he doesn't even do it in a way where, like, at least Tom Cruise was in the car, and you think, all right, well, maybe he's listening to it on the radio. But they were just, you know, Earl Partridge and Philip Seymour Hoffman's, was it Phil, the nurse? They're just in the room, just randomly break out in song. You know, every character, wherever they are, just start breaking out into song. And I'm thinking, well, that is the point where this is going to probably lose some people. Like, I was shocked when it was The Frogs that immediately people were like, all right, I've had enough. I'm done with this film.
And I mean, Tarantino with Pulp Fiction, on a completely different note, leads us into that in the beginning. He lets that be our setup. It lets it be our moment of going, this is what my movie is, and then it goes from there, right? Is it something different to let that be your base as opposed to being your finale? Is that what the problem is?
It might be. That's a good point, that it was the base. But even though it was the base, it's almost like he touches on it and then leaves it until the end. Because you don't really get the significance of it until the very end of the film, which I guess is what, you know, the beginning, depending on how you, if you look at it chronologically. But at the end of the film, when he's talking about it and he's like, yeah, I was quoting the Bible because it was cool, you know, but now I'm thinking maybe I need to be a good person, you know, and I'm just going to start walking the earth, helping people like Kane and Kung Fu. You know, and that's when I said, huh, that's interesting, because people were willing to go with that. You know, it starts off initially, and then the film just goes on its own various tangents, you know, talking about watches being up people's asses and giving a girl adrenaline injections, all that stuff. And then it goes back to, oh, yeah, all the while, this is the point I'm trying to make. We need to be good to each other, you know, and start doing good things, because the people who do bad, i.e. Travolta, are going to end up dying, you know. But the people who do good deeds, like Bruce Willis and Jules, they will go on and live their life. Whereas with this one, I think Anderson tries to do something similar at the beginning with the setup, but he does it with random coincidences, right? Those three great stories of the scuba diver,
Scuba diver. There's the parents who accidentally shoot their child, and then there's Greenberry Hill.
And even if you look at the parents, because the Greenberry Hill one, you go, okay, that is a simple coincidence. The scuba diver one with Patton Oswalt, that is where things kind of ratchet up a notch. You're like, okay, so, you know, hours before, these guys had a fight, and then it just so happens that the dealer loves to go scuba diving, and all this craziness happens. And then you get to the parents, and he's even drawing, like, diagrams on the screen to make sure that you know how all this craziness is actually tied together. So Buddy's about to jump, but if you notice down here, there's a net. He would have landed safely because they just happened to be doing construction on the apartment. But as he flew down the window at this point X, he got shot by his own parents because he loaded the gun that they were supposed to shoot each other with. You know, I'm thinking that alone is pretty out there. And that's the first 15 minutes. And then it kind of slowly settles down, gets into a rhythm, and then you have that musical sequence, which takes it back up a notch. And I'm thinking, okay, that's, you know, the breaking point. But no, it keeps it going, and then the last 10 minutes because, you know, people, a lot of the people still aren't changing, even though he makes a reference to repeating the cycles of the past, and, you know, people need to change or else they're going to keep falling, and they don't change. So something big happens to make them change. And then everyone just went, wait a minute, what? Frogs? Whereas, I don't know, I think he gets a bit of a bad rap for that. Whereas people, because Pulp Fiction was such a cool, unique film for its time, and technically, heck, it still is, I think people were more willing to just ignore all the stuff that happens in Tarantino's thing. Like, you know, he had a glowing suitcase. That's cool. No one knows what it is because you can make it up yourself. You know, whereas frogs, oh my God, he's trying to throw religion at us, you know, and...
And you know what's the weirdest thing is that when I first saw this film, and I think I saw this film for the first time probably like 6 or so years ago.
Okay.
So I wasn't a young gun. You know, I was young, but I wasn't a teenager. Religion wasn't the first thing I thought about when the frogs came down. Like, I just thought something crazy happened here. Mm-hmm. I have no clue what's going on, but something crazy just happened, and I didn't go to God. That was the worst. That was the weirdest part that I'm trying to remember.
And see, and I think it's because of my religious upbringing. Like, you know, my wife and I are churchgoers. Don't ask me to quote the Bible because I don't know the Bible that well. But I still like the idea of believing in a higher power, and that's just me. But when that frog scene happened, it wasn't one of those things where I went, oh, well, this was from this section of the Bible. What? No, I was like, that's a biblical. Like, to me, that just, because there was so much other little, I guess, knocks or little notches towards biblical allegory from before, like within the first 2.5 hours, that I was like, that seems like it's a God thing, especially when they didn't have there was no reports of like a plane explosion or a helicopter losing cargo. And I'm like, okay, you know, that he's been hinting at it, and finally something happened, and it was like, oh, that's kind of cool. But I liked how he did it because it just happens and then life goes on, right? It wasn't you need to be better Christians or you people need to read the Bible. It was, we'll take the notion of religion and faith and just, you know, and what is it really trying to say? We're not trying to say go to church every week. We're not trying to say even read the Bible. We're just saying, hey, be good to one another, because if you're not good to one another, sometimes things happen that no one can control that'll force you to wake up and be good to one another.
Yeah, and I mean, I think there's nothing else one can hope for in life than that moment of someone realizing that being good to another person is probably better than most things you would do in your life. But I'm kind of curious, since even talking about that frog moment and talking about what your mind associates with you, as you say, being being religious, being not as you said, you can't quote the Bible, but you believe in the higher power and you're a church going individual. Do you generally take that church to the cinema?
I don't know if I take it to the cinema, but there are times where I will notice things. I think the last time where I can honestly remember having it be a huge impact on how I viewed a film was, oddly enough, Tree of Life. And Tree of Life was a film that people were just raving about from Cannes. And I remember the first week it came out, people were just going crazy over Tree of Life and the feeling that they got from it and the message. And when I went to see Tree of Life, I was like, all right, this is going to be an interesting experience. And it was, for me, visually stunning, but I found myself kind of being detracted from the whole spiritual aspect of it. Because I was like, oh, well, you know, all these meditative questions that Malick is asking or posing, I'm like, this is, you know, what I hear at church, right? It's like, it wasn't anything new or profound. It didn't really make me think of life or faith any different way, right? So I started focusing more on like the Brad Pitt storyline, like that, and how he was raising his boys. That I found was engaging. As I said, the visuals, but the stuff with Sean Penn really, really bothered me. And that was the only time where I can distinctly remember sitting in the theater going, wow, I've brought too much of my outside life into the theater. Right. And that rarely happens. Usually if a film has, religious allegory or religious themes, I will notice it and be like, oh, all right, that's interesting. You're doing that with it. But Tree of Life was the one where it was almost kind of made me distance myself from the film more. And it's one that I'm eager to go back to, because enough time has passed now where I'm willing to go back to Tree of Life and look at it from a different perspective. Now that I already know what to expect, I can kind of just push that religious stuff aside and view the film on its own. Whereas something like Magnolia, I was picking out the religious themes, but it wasn't, you know, changing how I view religion, or wasn't even making me think of what I learned in church. It was just kind of like, oh, that's an interesting way. Like, I find it more fascinating when someone will use religion in a way where you taking the overall themes and concepts. You know, you don't necessarily need to tell people by quoting the Bible directly or doing like the Passion of Christ. We must show you the hardship of what the Bible said so you believe. It's, you know, that's not how religion is, because even though I'm a church going individual, I'm still like, I have my own views on what I think God is and what faith is in general, you know, whereas I know other people in that building on a Sunday are more, the Bible says this, the, you know, can quote this verse, can quote that verse. I'm like, you can quote 18 verses, 25 verses, that's great, but you're still not necessarily a nice person, even though I see you come to church every week, you know? So it's just, I guess it all just depends on how you interpret it. When I go to the theater, I just go to see a film. If there happens to be religious themes in it, hey, that's cool, you know? I might pick some out, some I might even miss. But I don't, outside of that one instance of Tree of Life, I've never really brought that outside world, or, you know, had my, whatever my individual beliefs are, change how I view a film. Majority of the time I'm just like, all right, that's what you decide to do with it, that's great, or yeah, it didn't work that well for me, but, you know, I'm still willing to go with it.
So there, as you said, there are a few cases like Magnolia where your religious understanding and your religious knowledge have enriched the film, and there are cases where Tree in Life where you almost felt it got in the way of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything where a film that you experienced actually attempted to enrich your understanding of faith and belief?
That's a good question. I don't know. It's funny because I think the films that I like, the ones that I'm thinking that immediately come to mind, probably aren't the best in terms of religion, in enriching what I think of religion. Like, often it's more showing the evils of religion or the sins of religion. You know, even something like Black Narcissus, which I saw for the first time a few years ago and absolutely loved. I've seen it several times, I think, within the span of, what, 2 years. You know, again, a lot of religious themes in that, but that doesn't necessarily paint religion in a good light. You know, so religion is almost seen as a burden in that film. But I can't, on the spot, I'm tough to think of one that went, yeah, you know, that really changed, like, you know, enhanced my view of religion. Cause I just find in cinema in general, maybe it's cause it's just more interesting to show the ill effects of religion, how too much religion or believing, not necessarily too much religion, but believing in an established view of what religion should be, opposed to everyone having their own thoughts and ideas of what it should be, you know, is an evil thing, and usually is a villainous thing, right? So, like, even in action films, like, what was the one that Arnold did? Was it End of Days or something, where he was like fighting the devil and?
Oh, I don't think I've actually seen that movie, because when that was released, I was too young to go and watch it.
Oh, you're not missing anything. but yeah, like, even in those type of mindless action films, it was, you know, it's the good and evil. Evil is always the devil, you know, and things that deal with religion. Like, I'm thinking back to, what was that controversial film? Priest, back in the, what was it, I guess, mid-90s, where even that one wasn't, I thought the controversy was kind of overblown, but again, it was just because people were, you know, it was talking about religion and priesthood, and it was showing them in a negative light. And I was like, well, you know, priests don't always have to be angelic, right? Like, it was interesting. Or even Doubt. Like, Doubt's a perfect example where it's all what happened. No one's quite sure what happened, but they believe what happened was sinful, So this is what's causing the whole kerfuffle. And you've got the two sides. You've got the Meryl Streep side and the Hoffman side, and Amy Adams is kind of in the middle, right? But there's very few films where I think kind of paints religion or the idea of believing in a good light, or at least that I can think of off the top of my head. I can only think of bad examples, so that might say something.
I think that might say something about the opinion of filmmakers out there.
Yes.
Very much so in the same discussion that people have when they talk about the image of women in movies. But, you know, we can move on from those things.
Oh, that is another...
another thick topic.
Yeah, that's an episode onto itself. But even if... Sorry, let's just jump on that for a minute. If you think of, like, how the women are portrayed in this film, it's still a very male-heavy film. Because it's really a lot of fathers and sons. Like, you see Julianne Moore's character, and she's not the best of women, because she's the gold digger, you know. You've got Claudia, but Claudia's the damaged one, and she's been damaged by the father. The only one that I thought was, like, an actual really strong, interesting character was the interviewer, Guinevere.
Yeah.
I found her scenes with Tom Cruise fascinating, because she's the one that's kind of cutting through all the male bravado and is really getting to the heart of the issue. She's stripping down this facade and finding the man. And then through that, you find out that Tom Cruise's mother was actually, you know, a good woman who died. And then he was raised by the neighbor who was seemingly a great woman, but, you know, just type of thing. Like, that was interesting. In this film, the women aren't necessarily shown in the best of light. Like, even the woman that that John C. Reilly's character meets at the very beginning, that has the dead body in the closet, you know, loud, boisterous woman. Like, she, you know, there's very few strong female role models in this film. Now that I think about it, except for Guinevere.
I mean, the only other woman in this movie who is a very much a minor character is Jimmy Gator's wife.
Yes.
Right. Who we know not enough about to say that she's a good or a bad woman, but based on what we see, she seems good enough, I guess.
Yeah. She seems good enough. She just didn't know what was going on, you know. And mm-hmm. again, we don't know too much of that relationship or that history to see, well, were there any warning signs? And the only other female I can think of is that probably had more scenes than Jimmy Gator's wife was Felicity Huffman's. What was her name? Cynthia, the one that was hurdling the kids.
The showrunner.
And even her, she seems like a very nice woman at the beginning, but then when Stanley needs to go to the washroom, she's telling him no, no, no. And when Ricky Jay's character is asking her what's the problem, she's like, oh, no, there's no problem. There's no problem. Like, she's trying to keep everything hush hush, right? So she's, again, that's not enough to define whether or not she's good or bad. It's just she's kind of one of those characters where you don't get enough from her to really make an informed decision. But right. I will say, if I can go on a tangent, one of my favorite sequences in that film is the tracking shot. Like, I know it's now kind of standard for Paul Thomas Anderson to have a great tracking shot, but in particular, when Stanley first gets to the television station and they follow him and Cynthia as they're going through the whole place, the father's going off on his way, and it's a great – one thing I love about that tracking shot is it was one of the few times where I actually noticed a tracking shot where it gave the impression of almost two levels, because the camera keeps following them into the elevator, and then it backs out from the elevator, and they are now on a different floor where you get to the office of Jimmy Gator, and it has, like, the handle right by his nose, which was always kind of odd to me. But I thought from a technical standpoint, that was always really fascinating how he did that.
Yeah, I think this movie, like, as you said, it's kind of standard now that when you know a Paul Thomas Anderson movie is on, you're gonna get one of those. But I feel like this movie, it almost felt like it would have two or three in the film. I can't point them out in my head other than that obvious one in the station. But, like, there's so many moments in this movie where it feels like things are happening, and they just feel so fluid. I mean, you even have the moment, and it's such a small moment, of when Quiz Kid Donnie Smith gets to work. And
oh, yes.
It feels like there might be one there, even though it's kind of small. But throughout this movie, you feel this fluidity, where you always feel go, go, go. and the movie refuses to stop for us, which is one of the things that kind of attracted me towards this movie, and it keeps doing it every time I watch it. One thing I want to ask about, and even though I really don't want to get bogged down into the idea of defining this movie even more, but there's one aspect which I keep focusing on more and more every time I watch this movie, and that is the young child, who I believe is only referred to in this movie as Worm. The young black child, who John C. Reilly has a scene with where he raps off a rhyme. And it, like, every time I listen to that, I find more and more of what the movie actually does in it. And as I watch the movie and I notice him more and more, I feel like what they keep shouting about in that great scene that we talked about with Quiz Kid Donnie Smith and the older gentleman in the bar, you shouldn't confuse young children with angels. Am I supposed to believe that child is an angel?
I believe he is, but the interesting with that rap scene is I remember seeing it in the theater and like you thinking that he is Worm, but Worm is actually, I guess, his older brother, if I remember correctly. And even though I've watched this film countless times, I still can't decipher all of what he is rapping. But what I got from it was that the Worm was his brother who noticed, the Worm was his uncle who noticed that his, I believe, I'm thinking it's his mother, who the woman in the earlier part of the film was being abused by her husband, and he's the one who killed the husband.
Mm-hmm.
She just hit him in the closet. There's a line in there, and I had made a note of it. I can't even remember where it is now, where in his rap, he makes reference to if something doesn't change, then the Lord be raining or something like that. Right. And it was and again, it goes back to that whole if you don't change, something's going to happen. Lord's going to. And I did it, the first couple times. I just flew over that line. I'm like, oh, all right, whatever. That's just him rapping. And then as I started thinking back, I'm like, no, he is kind of like the all-seeing angel. When Philip Seymour Hoffman loses his gun, he's the one that finds it.
Yeah.
And what happens to the gun later? It falls from the sky, right? When Julianne Moore is about to kill himself, he's the one that's there, right? So it was kind of like, oh, so I guess he is kind of an angel
in
of sorts.
In a sense.
Yeah, like even when they're having the breakdown at the game show, where is that kid? He's in a room with other kids watching that show as it's happening, right? So it was interesting how, like I know on the DVD, in some of the deleted scenes, they actually have Worm, who I guess was played by Orlando Jones, and there's a few scenes with him and the kid that I guess is supposed to explain more, but really doesn't explain that much more. You just kind of see who the Worm is, but I think that is true, because when Thurston's talking about confusing kids with angels and how horrible it is, Donnie's the first to chime up and say, no, children can be angels. And I guess what I interpreted from that whole scene is that children, when they're born, they're angels, but it's the world around them and their parents that corrupt them and turn them evil, you know?
Yeah,
I could be way off on that, but that was
I've brought up the actual lyrics from the rap.
Oh, yes, good.
And it says towards the end of it, and he's running from the devil, but the debt is always gaining. And if he's worth being hurt, he's worth bringing pain in. When the sun doesn't work, the good Lord bring the rain in.
Raining.
So, so I mean, throughout this movie, we've seen these weather interludes where it gets more rain, it gets sunshine, it's cloudy, it's overcast. Towards the end, we finally see the frogs come down, which is what we assume he's meaning by the good Lord bring the rain in, right? Mm-hmm. It's interesting to try to map this small moment towards the rest of the film as to the actual structure of it. But it's always a fear that I've had with this movie, as I said, which is why I keep harder and harder to try and define it. I'm only going to find those problems that the naysayers find in the movie.
Yes, but I think with that rap, especially because when that rap occurs, it happens before the weather change where it's actually raining, right? Because it's only after that scene and a few others where you actually see the rain start coming down, you know, and that's when the mood of the film starts to change a bit. And there's that great scene where I think there's like really two intermissions in this film. The second one being the musical interlude, but there's also the scene where Jimmy Gator is talking on the show and he's getting the audience ready for the show. But Paul Thomas Anderson kind of uses it as a way to show overall where every character's at, because he's talking about our children. You know, the kids are up, you know, are still playing, but the adults are, I forget the exact terminology, but like the adults are up for the challenge, you know, and these kids might be over their heads for this week's competition. And they're showing you every character of where they are in that scene. So Julianne Moore is in the pharmacist. Phil's on the phone trying to get a hold of Frank T.J. Mackey. And it's a great thing because he's, when you had the rap about It Be Raining, at that point in the film when Jimmy Gator's doing his little spiel on the show, you know, the weather is really bad. It's storming out, and you're thinking, oh, this is when it's going to get, this is the rain that he was talking about. Something big's going to happen. And it's just all the characters keep getting, you know, further down that hole. You know, they're not coming out right. So I think the rap at first seems almost like a red herring, because the rain happens, you're like, oh wait, it's raining, but these characters aren't getting any better, they're actually getting worse. When does the frogs hit? When it's actually clear out, you know, that you think, all right, things have improved a bit, the skies have now broken free, the rain has stopped, but the characters still haven't changed, you know. So Mother Nature did her part and they didn't change, so now you've got to bring in the biblical event, if you will. And I found that kind of interesting in terms of how it ties into the rap. Like, the rap is such an important part of that film, but it's done in a way that, because you have a child rapping, you don't necessarily pick up on all the stuff that's in it. Like, you know, if you hadn't pulled out the – I didn't even think of ever pulling up the lyrics to that. It's just one of those – every time I decipher, I have to stop, rewind, like, wait, what did he say? Like, I still can't get all this rap. I didn't even think to go online and research the actual word for word, right?
But the internets will have it. That's always
the internet is a great thing.
It ruins all arguments because you finally get the facts.
That's right.
I don't even know where else to go with this movie because it's so out there. But there is one question I have to ask before we ever think about ending this conversation, because we've talked about so many things as it relates to this movie, but I'm still curious about the idea of you sharing this movie with people. And now that you've told me that you have yet to share this with your wife, I'm very curious about whether you're still considering, or if you've gotten to that point where you're starting to consider sharing this movie with your wife.
It's interesting. When I was watching it again, I mean, I think it's a film she'll sit through. To get off on a little tangent, my wife was never a big movie person. She's watched a fair bit, but since she's been with me, she's seen a whole lot more. And, you know, she even will come out to TIFF for one day and she'll see two or three films and that's it. But she has a weird criteria for her movie watching. So it can't be a film that's too violent, which I made the mistake, I think it was like two or three years ago at TIFF. We saw this film from the Congo called Viva Riva. And I thought, going in, because of the write-up and the picture, I thought it was going to be like an African kind of James Bond. And it turned out to be like an African Goodfellas Mean Street. So it was a lot of sex and violence, and she ended up walking out halfway through. So I read, okay, that's not her thing. So she doesn't want extreme, like realistic violence, and she doesn't want horror. But at the same time, she loves Demolition Man, right? And she loves things. So it's one of those weird things where if the violence is too realistic, she doesn't like it. But if it's science fiction, like Fifth Element or Demolition Man, she'll watch it. Or if it's a foreign film, whatever, she'll watch it, right? So it's where this one, I think, meets her criteria of, in terms of, I can show it to her. You know, with a two-year-old around, I don't even know if we have 3 hours to spare to watch it. But I don't know. Right now, I'm still at that, you know, I've been burned too many times with it. So I think I'm going to wait maybe another year and then.
Okay.
And then I'll try and show it to her again.
All right, well, I want to thank you so much for coming and talking with me, Courtney.
Thank you for having me. I love this show, and I also love the other one that you do.
Oh, thank you so much.
So that was the episode. I hope I didn't overhype the show for you guys. Did I? Should I? I should probably stop doing these crazy ass intro and outros like this. But I like them. Do you like them? I like them. That was the show. I'm really happy with how it turned out, as I mentioned before. As always, go and listen, go and read Courtney Small's wonderful words over at cinemaaxis.com and follow him on Twitter. He's at smallmind. Also, I'm, as you know, I'm at gmanreviews on Twitter, the website. You can find all these episodes at is gmanreviews.com as well as through iTunes or Stitcher. And go and subscribe, rate, review the show. It really helps. It really gives me, like, a real sense of moral boosting every time I go there and I see new things there. I'm like, oh yay, people found it, it's cool, it's awesome. And otherwise, anything else I want to tell you? We're coming up to the end of the year, and I have something special planned. I'm working on it, and I hope it'll turn out as cool as my brain thinks it's gonna be. I hope you guys will like it, so look forward to that. But we'll have a few extra things before that, I think. So yeah, thanks for listening and good night. And you have-